I'm John Krall. On today's No Limits, we're going to talk about an issue that has split the state, Indiana's new controversial abortion law. It's prompted protests on the statehouse lawn, phone campaigns directed at Governor Mike Pence's office, and a legal challenge. We'll talk about both about what the law says and what the fight is about. My guests are Jane Henniger, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana, and Republican strategist Marcus Barlow. Please join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about Indiana's new abortion law, the one that has spurred a lot of interest on both sides of the question here in the state. If you would like to join the conversation, and I anticipate many people will, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jane Henniger, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Indiana, and Marcus Barlow, who is a Republican strategist. Welcome to both of you.
It's good Thanks. To be here.
Thank you both for being here. I probably should start, though, the conversation with a couple of disclosures. One is an obvious one. I have to remind the audience, they've heard this before, that at one time earlier in my career, I held what was sort of Jane's position with what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, now is the ACLU of Indiana. The other thing I'd like to say is before we get the calls asking why certain people weren't here, we did issue invitations to Governor Mike Pence, Casey Cox, the legislator who authored the law, and Indiana Right to Life and all of that, and they declined the invitation. So I want to, before we get those calls, I want to say, yes, we did attempt to get them in and let them talk about their motivations and their reasoning. So I'm going to start first by just asking, I want to set a baseline for this discussion. What does this law do? What specifically does it do? Marcus, I'm going to start with you, but I want to hear both of you because I think there are even some interesting arguments about definition here, too.
Right.
Marcus.
Well, I think it is at its base, it puts some restrictions on and some more regulations on how abortions are performed in Indiana. And Mike Pence, as well as the supermajority Republican supermajority in the House, in the Senate, this is something that they ran on. This is something that they talked about. And so I think this bill is a result of them kind of fulfilling the promises of what they've talked about, in which one of those things is to protect life.
Jane?
Yeah, well, I would say there are three major provisions, and mainly because we're challenging three of the main provisions of this law. And none of them, I would say, are about how abortions are performed. The most concerning and clearly unconstitutional aspect of this law is when abortions may be performed. The one provision of the law bans abortions based on a woman's reasons, and say that that prohibits abortion if the sole reason for the abortion is the fetus's race, color, national origin, ancestry, sex, or diagnosis of a statutorily defined disability or a potential diagnosis of a disability. The second provision, which we're challenging, is part of amendment into the informed consent requirement of the existing laws governing and regulating abortion and abortion providers. And that says that a nurse, doctor, prior to a woman receiving an abortion, at least 18 hours prior to a woman receiving the abortion, has to hear that the state of Indiana does not allow a woman to have an abortion if her reason is one of those listed reasons. And then the third provision that we're challenging is a requirement that fetal tissue after an abortion or a miscarriage be disposed of differently than other medical material.
So, Marcus, let me, what problem was this bill trying to solve? I mean, evidence, almost all legislation is an attempt to deal with a problem of some kind. What was the one this was supposed to address?
Right. Well, you know, just to kind of go off the 3 points that she just mentioned, the when abortions may be performed, this is something that we've seen in other states. 8 other states have restrictions to performing abortions for gender, Illinois being one of them. The informed consent, I mean, you know, I can't speak for every legislator specifically, but I think there's nothing wrong with giving people information, especially when you have a new law, to let them know what's going on. And then the disposal of fetal tissue, I mean, we all lived through the many stories exposing what Planned Parenthood had been doing with aborted tissue. And so I think this is a response to that, to try to make sure that we are disposing of this tissue in a respectful way.
Jane, where did you see the motivation for this bill coming from?
We see it akin to the motivation of these laws, targeted restriction laws that have cropped up across the country, not only this year, but for decades. There were 400 similar bills, not similar in the sense of regulating, narrowing, sometimes, as in this case, outright prohibiting abortion across the country. So 400 in 2015 alone of these restrictions were imposed. The intent is to limit a woman's access to her constitutional right to have an abortion. And that couldn't be clearer. And in this law's instance, it crosses the line and does an outright ban of a woman's decision to end a pregnancy.
Most of the popular opposition, I'm going to stay with you for a second, mm-hmm. Jane, but I will give Marcus a crack at this as well. Most of the popular opposition to it comes with that first part, the reason, the motivation for an abortion being the part that is going to be regulated. I'm going to start first by asking, why do you think, I mean, that is sort of the rationale for, you know, the periods for Pence, the phone calls that are bombarding the governor's office, where women are calling in and reporting where they are in their reproductive cycles and all of that. Why is it that part seems to be upsetting people more than others? Because I'll be honest, I don't hear nearly as much opposition to, you know, the informed consent provision or the disposal of the tissue as I do that first part.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think that there's several reasons. One is that this law, again, prohibits a woman's right to end a pregnancy in consultation with her family, her doctor, and it gets to John, that a woman making that decision in sometimes the most painful personal circumstances. And women who have received a diagnosis are often women who have wanted a pregnancy. And to have a diagnosis, and sometimes, you know, out of the blue, unsuspected, to have a politician, a group of politicians inserted almost into that doctor's office in that conversation that the woman has with her doctor, with a nurse, with her family, is insulting to women. It demeans their ability to control their lives. It demeans a woman's ability to assess whether she's able to handle a pregnancy, handle the whatever outcome may come from that pregnancy removes her ability to make those choices for what's best for her and her family. And I think that's why it's resonated in so many ways across so many individuals, including many Republican female legislators who oppose this bill, because they felt that because of the extraordinary nature of this law, that it took a step too far in intruding politicians into a woman's decision.
Marcus.
Well, you know, I think that it's important that we stop dividing who can talk about this issue and who can't based on their gender. I think that abortion is something that is a large issue for our society as a whole. It says something about us as a people, where we decide that life begins and what rights does that unborn life have. We've seen many restrictions in the past that have been widely popular. Partial birth abortion. A majority of Americans don't want to see partial birth abortions happening. So putting restrictions is nothing new. And as I said before, eight other states have restrictions where based on gender. And so that's nothing new. And so now we're saying, you know, should we now look at this and say that, you know, a child that's disabled can have a fruitful and meaningful life? And what does that say to us about society as a society as to whether or not we are protecting that life or not? And our elected representatives are there to communicate in law how we feel as a society. And so I don't see this as, you know, politicians trying to get in the middle of someone's private decision. The law is there to define what it is that we should and should not be doing as a society.
A woman's right to make this decision is exactly what this is about. This isn't about abortion. The Supreme Court for over 40 years has been very clear that a woman has the right to make this decision, to determine with herself, her family, her doctor, the course of a pregnancy and the course of her reproductive life. This isn't about abortion, because the Supreme Court has been very clear about this. This isn't a restriction. This is a prohibition. This is incursion on what the Supreme Court has said is clearly a woman's scope of decision. And I agree with you, Marcus. I don't think that it's a discussion just for women. And many men and women come down on the personal issue of how they feel about abortion differently. But regardless of how we feel about abortion personally, what the Supreme Court has said is that the Constitution guarantees a woman's right to decide for herself.
And if I could, let me throw in real quickly, because I'm going to keep us on this topic, but a question should be asked: what are the penalties associated with having an abortion on these, and how do you enforce this? How do you prove the motivation? Marcus, I'll go with you first on
that
one.
First, I just wanted to respond to the fact that, you know, the Supreme Court has also not prohibited the prohibition to partial birth abortions. So, you know, to act like this is an absolute private choice, the Supreme Court has allowed some restrictions, prohibitions, whatever we want to call it, the Supreme Court has, as well as eight other states have the same restriction, prohibition, whatever you want to call it, based on gender, and North Dakota has one also based on disability as well. And that challenge was thrown out. So, you know, just to address that, as far as, you know, your question, if you could say it again.
Well, my question really was, is how do you demonstrate, how do you prove the motivation, and what are the penalties associated with violating this law?
Well, I think that, you know, it's important to point out a fact that this bill states that if these restrictions are for the sole reason, so if the sole reason is based off of gender, race, disability, then this bill would come into effect. There are many factors, I'm sure, that go into making this decision, but if this is the sole reason, then this bill would come into effect. And the bill is focused on providers and facilities, not individual women. So I think those are important distinctions to make.
Okay. Yeah, so the penalties are, as Marcus said, he's absolutely right, that the law puts the penalty on the provider, on the doctor. And then and that's consistent with how these restrictions have gone on around the country. And as famously brought out, illuminated by Donald Trump, saying that women ought to be punished for violating these laws. And the focus then was said, oh, no, it's on the provider. I want to be clear that limiting access to an abortion penalizes women. It may not give them a criminal liability, but it certainly penalizes them.
We are in the middle of a very lively conversation about Indiana's new abortion law. We're going to share some listener feedback as soon as we come back from this break. We are talking about Indiana's new abortion law with Jane Henniger, the executive director of the ACLU of Indiana, and Republican strategist Marcus Barlow. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indiana's new abortion law here on No Limits. My guests are Jane Henniger, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Indiana, and Marcus Barlow, who is a Republican strategist. If you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Jerry has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, those of us who thought that last year's firestorm over RFRA might convince the Republican caucus to proceed more cautiously and deliberately with controversial legislative action are presented instead with a law whose only ultimate impact will be to reinforce for the rest of the nation that Hoosier is a synonym for idiot. I share Ms. Henniger's confidence that federal courts will eventually, if not promptly, consign House Enrolled Act 1337 to the dustbin of history. In the process of expressing my disappointment personally to my state senator, I learned that most of the supermajority legislators who voted for it were largely unaware of its enormous and catastrophic implications. He presented it to me as a bill that began as a comparatively innocuous effort to regulate the disposal of fetal remains, but which grew without his knowledge into its final monstrous form. He gave me the firm impression that in the end his yea vote was more of a bow to the superior wisdom of his caucus than an affirmation of his reasoned personal opinion. My questions for the Republican strategist. Does not the mere existence of a supermajority caucus in the legislature virtually guarantee that some noxious legislation will pass without due deliberation? How much responsibility for such travesties is the Republican Party willing to accept?
Well, I think we can assume,
Marcus, that he's not a fan.
Okay. Well, Jerry, I appreciate the question, yeah. But I disagree with many of the premises you put forward. You know, and just there's a lot to unpack there, but I'll try to hit everything. You know, what he said about the RFRA controversy, you know, and I will fully admit that, you know, Democrats and the left did a very good job of trying to convince us that, you know, there should be all out panic because of RFRA. But what we saw since RFRA has not lived up to the panic that people tried to make us think. The Indianapolis convention business did not suffer because of it. Indiana continues to add jobs and add investment. Under Governor Pence, we've added 130,000 new jobs. There are more Hoosiers working today than have ever been working in the history of our state. And unemployment and investment are investments at a record high, and unemployment continues to go down. So, you know, I think some of these controversies make for good media stories, but they don't actually play out into real life. And I see the same thing with this bill. I mean, I think that, you know, when you as voters are electing a supermajority Republican, and in Indiana itself, Indiana is a pro-life state. We've elected pro-life governors the last three elections. We've elected pro-life legislatures, and now we have a supermajority pro-life legislature. I think that a lot of people that are predicting gloom and doom should just look at what's been happening here, and they'll see that that's a misplaced fear.
In fairness, though, Marcus, it wasn't just Democrats and liberals who were concerned about RFRA, and they aren't the only ones who have expressed concerns about this. I mean, you know, in the case of RFRA, major corporations, the Chamber of Commerce, a lot of big employers said, whoa, this is not going to help us compete on the national stage, in national and international stage.
And I understand that that's what they said. I'm just saying that the reality of it has not played that out. The facts on the ground, what actually happened as opposed to what people were saying, the reality is completely different.
I'll ask a question that probably will make Jane a little uncomfortable here. But with RFRA, and this, again, I probably ought to do the disclosure that I was the executive director of what was the ACL. But at times like this, when people feel that your constituency feels that basic rights are being imperiled, they express that concern in a couple of ways. They either become members or they start writing larger checks. Have you seen fundraising and membership increase during this period?
We've certainly heard from people in a variety of ways that they are alarmed at this law. They, too, have, like the email listener, have linked this double whammy of to our state's reputation. They certainly are not pleased that there is this constant assault, in part because the legislature is not representing the public. They're not representing Indiana, and they're not representing the national majority either. Majority of Hoosiers and the majority, just like the majority of Americans, believe in protecting a woman's right to make this decision, regardless of their own personal feelings about abortion. 70 to 80% of people believe in protecting a woman's right to have an abortion, and with reasonable regulations, and that's under that guise. There's been all these regulations over the years, but that fundamental right is supported by the majority of Americans.
If you were just joining us, we are talking about Indiana's new abortion law. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Rick has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
I have called the governor's office to get some answers that I have asked them. What I don't understand, and I'm a very left Democrat, and you know, I think abortion should be limited. It's wrong. But yet, no Republican is willing to teach how not to have an abortion. And then in regards to Pence, you know, he wants these developmentally disabled people to be born. And I work with the developmentally disabled. But yet he continues to cut back on social services. So I just don't understand the dichotomy of this thinking. It just doesn't make sense. Let's teach our people how not to have an abortion. And let's support the people that are disabled. Let's support them and support the loving families. I just don't get it.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions and comments. Jane, I'll let you respond first.
Yeah, so I think that's important to point out that this bill challenges and intrudes in a woman's decision that she can make with her doctor, her family, but it highlights what happens to individuals with disabilities in this state. We at the ACLU have a number of cases on our docket where we are representing individuals with often severe disabilities who are being denied support and services to which they are entitled by the state of Indiana based on cutbacks, based on arbitrary decisions. And so we agree that there ought to be services that help individuals and their families live out their lives.
Marcus.
Yeah. Well, I guess I just have to disagree that the services definitely exist. I know this personally, because I have a sister in Indiana who is disabled and is receiving services through FSSA and through the Department of Disability and Rehabilitative Services. And she is living a very fruitful, successful life in Indiana using those services. So, you know, I think the characterization that Republicans only care about you when you're unborn is unfair and untrue. Republicans definitely want to make smart decisions about where we're spending money. But at the same time, I think you haven't seen Republicans wanting to end these services for people. You know, when Rick's another part of Rick's call that I think was important was that he said that he thought abortion should be limited. And that's what we're talking about with this bill. We're talking about reasonable limitations. We're talking about reasonable restrictions. And I think that, you know, we can stand on different sides of where that reason is. But I think that, you know, having restrictions to abortions is nothing new. And it is something that a majority of Americans and a majority of Hoosiers do agree with.
To be fair to Rick, though, I didn't hear him say necessarily that it should be limited. He was saying that there should be fewer of them.
Well, and then he said it's wrong.
Yeah, it is wrong, but he didn't. And I guess that's a setup because that's something, you know, at least when I talk to people about this issue, regardless of where they fall on the moral question of whether, you know, abortion is evil and should be outlawed altogether or whatever, everyone, there seems to be a broad consensus that it is rarely a good outcome for anyone, the best, you know, that a happy outcome for anyone involved. You know, if I'm going to risk marching out into the middle of two lines with heavy guns trained so that I'm the only thing they can shoot at here. But, you know, there is a broad consensus out there that says, yeah, abortion ought to be legal, it ought to be safe, and there ought to be a whole lot fewer of them. Is there anything we can do so that we bridge this kind of gap? Because I think there is a public perception when we talk about abortion and reproductive rights that those voices in the middle simply are not being heard. Marcus, I'll start with you on that one.
You know, I think that you've brought up a very good point and somewhat of a dichotomy when you hear people talk about abortion rights, how, you know, when you get to kind of the Planned Parenthood extreme left and you have, you know, abortions for any reason at any time. But then you have, but it should also be rare. And my question has always been, well, if there's nothing wrong with it, then why would you also say there it should be rare? And that's because a majority of people do think that, you know, what Rick said, which is should be limited. And then Rick went on to say that it's wrong, and yet he still supports the right. And I think that, you know, people, we are in the middle of a discussion about where that line is. We're in the middle of a discussion about how do we accomplish that. And there are very many good groups out there that are doing crisis counseling for pregnancies. There are many groups, pro-life groups that are out there trying to reduce the number of abortions by, you know, showing women that there are other options and they can, you know, go through with these pregnancies and live a fruitful life, them and their child. But then on the other hand, there is a part to play for our legal system and how we regulate and what reasonable restrictions we can put on abortions to also achieve that goal as well.
John, I would say maybe to perhaps people's surprise, I would say that the ACLU is the voice in the middle. Our job is to protect individuals' constitutional rights as the Constitution lays them out, as the Supreme Court has illuminated them. That is, in America, the definition of the middle. And in this instance, it's very clear what side of the middle and that constitutional framework this law is on. It does not restrict abortion. It prohibits it in certain circumstances. It prohibits it based on a woman's rights. And we're talking about an abortion in the first trimester, and repeatedly the Supreme Court has said in that first trimester, a woman has a right to an abortion. She's a right to make that decision on her own, with her family, knowing her circumstances as only she does. There's nothing reasonable also about this prohibition. And a little bit of that goes to the enforcement question that you asked earlier. It's very difficult to imagine how this law will be enforced, A, because the fact that an abortion in the first trimester is constitutionally protected. Nobody asks a woman why she's getting an abortion now, because that's irrelevant and it's personal and intrusive. So unless she volunteers why she's making this decision, a provider wouldn't know. Second, and Marcus alluded to the fact that there are other states, a couple of other states, who have for years had prohibitions, a couple on basis of gender and a couple on the, I think one on the basis of race. And why those have stood is because those abortions aren't happening. It's a red herring. Women aren't having abortions because of fetus's race or color or national origin or gender, the other the restrictions that are currently on the books. And in the one state where there is a prohibition based on disability, potential disability, there was the one abortion clinic in that state did not perform those abortions. So that's why there wasn't standing to challenge it. And the enforcement is very hard, but on the face of the law, but the enforcement will have a real effect because it'll have the intended effect by the proponents of this legislation, which is to chill a woman's right to an abortion and to chill providers from providing that right. And that's clearly intended, because this isn't a widespread problem. This isn't, there aren't rampant amounts of abortions performed for these outlined reasons.
I'm learning we should have scheduled like 5 hours for this discussion. I want to let some of our listeners jump into the conversation, if that's okay, because I've got a phone bank full of calls right now. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
One of the things that's on my mind is, I don't know if you realize this or not, but 15% of fertilized eggs are actually spontaneously aborted. And the way this law is written, it does make women have to take pause. We actually had somebody ask us at the women's rally if they were going to go to jail if they had a miscarriage. So it just creates a lot of confusion of something that is constitutionally guaranteed. And I don't see any reason for it. I do not understand this. It criminalizes doctors. My husband's an emergency room physician. If somebody comes in and he thinks they, you know, are having a miscarriage and he is not clear on what has happened, he could actually be criminally held liable. It's a very intrusive, bad law.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm going to give Marcus a chance to respond to that. Thanks, Cheryl.
Yeah, and I appreciate the call as well. I think that a lot of the confusion has come from misinformation, chief of which in this whole periods for Pence thing was based off of misinformation, that when we're talking about miscarriages or aborted fetuses, we're talking about them at a facility or a clinic. So we're not talking about a woman at home that doesn't know what's happening being possibly prosecuted for something. That is just not what this bill was intended to do, and it's not what this bill does. So, you know, and when she was talking about her husband's example as well, one, I think that, you know, if we're talking about the disposal of fetal tissue, then I think that, you know, hopefully a doctor would recognize that that's what's happening and be able to dispose of that tissue properly. And two, it's not criminalizing doctors. It's adding restrictions, some of which have already existed. This is just expanding them.
And
I do want to
get to the confusion part, though. I agree with Marcus that there has been some undue alarm on the disposal issue, because it does only regulate if the abortion or miscarriage occurs in a healthcare facility or clinic.
We are talking about Indiana's new abortion law. We have a lot of interest in this one, so we're going to try to get as many people in as when we come back from the break. My guests are Jane Henniger of the ACLU of Indiana and Republican strategist Marcus Barlow. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indiana's new abortion law here on No Limits. My guests are Jane Henniger, the ACLU of Indiana, and Republican strategist Marcus Barlow. Before we dive back into that conversation, and we have a lot of listener interest, we're going to try to get as many calls and emails as possible in. I should say that we are aware that the rock star Prince has died. There's going to be more on that from NPR following this program, but we want everyone to know that we are aware of it and that we will have more information as it becomes available. We've gotten an email from a listener named Alex, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Alex says, I joined the conversation a bit late. My apologies if I'm asking a question that's already been covered. I heard Marcus rationalizing the legislation by connecting the fetal tissue sales by Planned Parenthood to the reasoning for the disposal provision of this law. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't that Planned Parenthood sting video and the subsequent series of allegations against Planned Parenthood get debunked a while ago? Why is it still being used by Republicans as justification for their religiously motivated provisions? And isn't forcing someone to intern or cremate from an abortion violating the religious clause in the First Amendment? Whatever happened to compassionate conservatives and small government? Marcus.
Well, first I'd like to say that I don't think that you have to be religious in order to think that human tissue deserves some sort of respect in the way that it's treated. As far as the Planned Parenthood sting videos go, I don't know when. I think that the selling of baby parts for profit had been debunked in some of the issues. But as far as the disposal of tissue goes, I think that the way that fetal tissue was disposed, as any other tissue or bandages or anything else was disposed, still was happening. So this provision was needed to separate that and make sure that human tissue was treated differently and with respect.
I agree that the Planned Parenthood allegations against Planned Parenthood have been debunked. It's also been clarified that this is not an issue in Indiana, in the practices of the Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky.
We are talking about Indiana's new abortion law here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Annette, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. And I want to thank Jane for all she does for our civil rights.
Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is, first of all, I organized the anti-RFRA rally last year, and I was also one of the organizers of the women's rights rally 2 weeks ago. And I find it interesting that I'm a Jewish woman, and in Jewish law, a life isn't viable until it's 31 days old. So to me, HB 1337 goes against what the governor passed regarding religious freedom, because Jewish women don't have that option if something happens. We have an illness in a genetic illness called Tay-Sachs, and the child that is born that has Tay-Sachs has no way to live past 2 or 3 years, and he's permanently handicapped, can't hear, can't speak, has no brain function. And there are so many anomalies that we're not even aware of. You know, everybody's talking about Down syndrome, but there are so many other anomalies that people aren't even aware of. So I think this bill is really dangerous.
Thanks very much for the call, Annette. Marcus, I'll give you the first crack at that one.
Right. Thanks as well, Annette. You know, I guess I didn't really understand what she was trying to say with the contradiction between religious freedom and the governor's pro-life views. But, you know, I do want to talk about, you know, this idea of wanting to put a restriction based off of disability and, you know, trying to pick out specific disabilities and this person would deserve to be protected over this person. I think the whole overreaching point is that we can't say, nor should we be the ones saying that a certain individual's life is worth more than another individual's life based on their disabilities, because there are many people, my sister included, who is living a very fruitful, very good life. I'm glad she's here. So, you know, when we start to get into these conversations, we can always get bogged down with this one specific example or that one specific example. But when you are pro-life like I am, like the governor is, like the Republican supermajority is, you do want to value every single life, despite what other values people might want to put on them.
Well, this is not.
I would say, John, that this is all about personal stories, right? I mean, I think you asked earlier why this issue, why this bill of all these restrictions has struck such a chord, and I think it's that so many women see the parts of themselves, see experiences in their lives potentially rising and being challenged by this law, and those are individual stories. We've heard many of them. Early on, a woman contacted us who had a child, very much wanted the pregnancy, had the child, had a disability that was fatal after 10 months. It was tragic for her. It was tragic for her family. She valued the time she had with her son. But she says she can't go through that again. Mm-hmm. And she would have, if she's lucky enough to have another pregnancy, she will get testing. And if she has to, under this law, do what she needs to protect herself and her family, she'll have to go to another state. But why should women be shamed, intimidated, forced to make these decisions with a politician in the room? They should do it with their family, with their doctor, and their conscience.
I gotta, and I hesitate, but I'm thinking, it's obvious this is, from the calls and all of that, this is a, you know, a deeply personal conflict for a lot of people. I mean, it cuts to really the core of who we are. And I think, I'm thinking as we're talking of a friend of mine who years ago, she and her husband had wanted to have a child and finally were able to conceive. They found out that the child, in effect, was going to be born without a brain, that as soon as it came, it basically would come out half. Perhaps a couple of minutes of agony and then be gone. In that case, Marcus, what is the harm in saying that, you know, she made the choice to abort? She didn't see that really as a life option. What is the harm in aborting for that kind of disability?
Well, you know, first, I'm not going to speak to that specific situation because I frankly don't know how this bill, the bill being written for the sole reason based off of gender, race, disability, I don't know what other reasons, what other things were going along, how that affects the health of the mother and whether or not that would be a factor as well, because Indiana has had a long tradition and still does that. You know, abortions for the health of the mother are not restricted. But I do want to address kind of the larger question that keeps coming up again that, you know, this is a decision that should just be private between the mother and the doctor. And I would have to disagree with that because I do think that abortion is a decision that it is a reality that does reflect on us as a society. And we've already seen that decision, that private decision, have reasonable restrictions to it that the public supports. So, you know, we can argue about whether this crosses some sort of, you know, metaphorical line.
Or constitutional line.
Right, where I would say that it doesn't because other states.
But the Supreme Court would disagree with you.
The Supreme Court hasn't heard anything like this before. So, you know,
yes,
I mean, we're both trying to predict something.
Well, and in fairness to both of you, neither of you is on the Supreme Court.
So, yeah, correct. So. Correct. Yeah, okay. Maybe one of us someday. So, you know, and I do think that this, getting back to my point, we have seen restrictions, we have seen prohibitions for certain reason in the past that are still going, that have still been upheld. And so we can argue over whether or not this is a reasonable one. But the idea of a prohibition or a restriction or increased regulations is nothing new.
I want to go ahead real quickly, and then I want
to
get more.
To just clarify something that pertains to the caller or the mm-hmm. email, and that is that there is an exception within the law if the disability will result in the death of a live birth and the death of within 3 months. But that's, another caller pointed out, there are so many disabilities that can be diagnosed in the womb that allow for a baby to live 4 months, or in the case of the example I gave you early, 10 months. There's no exception for that. There's no exception if the fetus dies in the womb. You know, it is an unprecedented prohibition, an intrusion on a woman's right to make this decision. And through ambiguous laws, through ambiguous language like ancestry and the way that it prohibits and inhibits what doctors can say, their ability to give information and to listen to what their patients want or need to say. This bill puts politicians into a woman's decision, into a doctor's office, in ways that are breathtaking and have been noted by the women, not just in Indiana, but across the country.
I'm going to try to get more listeners in on this. I'm going to ask both listeners and panelists to be brief from here on out because we are getting close on time. Joan, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello, Joan. Welcome to the program.
I had a question about how you enforce this law with the doctors. If the doctors don't know what the reason is, are they required to do tests before on the women? Are the women required to get tests? And if they don't know or should have known, will they still be punished?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Joan. Jane, you were shaking
your head. Testing is required by the law. And again, it's a very good question. And I think that's why this bill, a lot of the enforcement will come in intimidating both doctors and women from seeking an abortion by the specter of a violation, as the specter of a doctor losing his license, by what a woman might or might not say, or issues that might or might not come up.
Are doctors required to have the conversation? Or
they're
required to ask the question?
They are required to read that it's not allowed by state law, and they're also required to sign a form that addresses these issues. And as many doctors have pointed out to us, almost every pregnancy, especially pregnancies in women over 35, have the potential for a disability in the fetus.
We've gotten a comment via Twitter from a listener named Dan. If you'd like to find us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. He says, as a doctor, I recognize the intent of the law. It is one more assault on patients' privacy. More women will just leave the state for procedure. People can travel, you know. Marcus.
Well, I would say that, you know, this is the same. These are the same kind of talking points we always hear when there's any sort of restriction or prohibition, that it's unprecedented, that it's unreasonable, that people are going to leave the state because of it. But I would say that people living in Indiana, this is a pro-life state. This is, we can argue over where we put the restrictions, but restrictions have always existed. We have always had things that have played into when and where and how you can have an abortion. And this is, once again, pushing us closer to what people say they want, which is the rarity of abortions. And so, you know, we can try to paint a label on it by saying politicians being involved in it is where it goes wrong. But Politicians have already been involved in it. Politicians are involved in healthcare in general and the regulations that we have. So is this a proper role for them? And for me, I think it is, because as I've said before, I think this is a question for our whole society, and our laws reflect how we feel about this.
John, let me just point out that I agree with the doctor's frustration, but unfortunately, poor women don't have the option often of traveling. And that's what we're seeing across the country. These abortion restrictions are limiting the number of abortion providers, which is falling unduly and tragically on women who have limited means. And I'll say that that's tied to many abortions. The rate of abortion mirrors the rate of unintended pregnancies. And that the unintended pregnancies arise more in women in communities, women who are poor, who have limited access to contraceptives, to effective, more expensive contraceptives. So, you know, if we can limit unintended pregnancies, we will limit abortions. But many of those choices fall on women of limited means who don't have the option of traveling far to get the care they need.
I'm going to go with Sarah right now. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I do think it's interesting that former caller brought up sex education in Indiana, mm-hmm. in looking that our legislators have a primarily abstinence-based program, and what the young lady just said about unintended pregnancies. At any rate, Marcus, when you mentioned that politicians are involved, my question is, so implementing this law is going to result in many things, too numerous to mention, but it will result in a dramatic increase in the need for services, such as you were mentioning your family member receives. What provision was made for financing? Was there an actual specific intentional provision made by the government for a plan B after this law goes into effect? How
okay,
to take
Sarah,
care of these children and families?
Yeah, we're getting tight on time, and I want to give Marcus a chance to respond. Okay. Thank you very much for the call, Sarah.
Right. Well, the programs that exist are programs that are based off of need. So I don't know, you know, if she's saying that if more people needed the programs, we would need more programs. I think the programs that exist are based off of need.
Well, what she was asking is, how do we pay for it? Ultimately, where would the funding come from?
Right. And the funding will come from where the funding, you know, has always come from, which is Indiana taxpayers.
I'm going to ask real quickly, because there is a lawsuit that we really haven't had a chance to talk to about at all. Where does it stand right now, Jamie?
So we're seeking a preliminary injunction. Soon the litigants will be talking about scheduling the briefing and the oral argument that will be heard.
Okay. Well, I think that's probably going to have to be the last word. As I said earlier, we could easily do 5 hours on this. Jane and Marcus, I would like to thank both of you for having
a
very informative and civil conversation about a difficult issue. I also would like to thank our listeners for offering some great questions and participating in this conversation, also in an informative and civil fashion. Please stay tuned for more information about Prince's death. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.